Not interested. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Iran says it has no interest in President Trump's offer to sit down and talk. Iranian officials called the offer worthless. Hardly a surprise, says this Iran watcher.
What's in it for them, really? They don't need to have him validating the legitimacy of their government in the same way that Kim Jong-un of North Korea did.
But on the streets of the Iranian capital, one reporter is hearing a different reaction to Trump's offer.
A lot of people will tell you, of course we should talk to the United States. This is a perfect opportunity for us.
Plus, we get the latest from Love Island. It's the reality TV show that's got the UK head over heels.
For my money, Love Island is The Bachelor meets Mad Max.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us today. When President Trump sends out a tweet directed at Iran that says, "You will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before," all in uppercase, what I really want to know is, do Iranians feel like they're being shouted at?
In Persian font, you actually don't have uppercase.
It's right,
it's a reflection of Iranian culture where everybody tries to be very eloquent and very friendly, but at the same time, sometimes don't do exactly what they were saying they would do. But no, we don't have any uppercase here.
We'll go back there to Tehran in a moment. But first, to the back and forth between President Trump and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. Last week, it was saber-rattling, but then yesterday, Trump had a different message for Iran.
If we could work something out that's meaningful, not the waste of paper that the other deal was, I would certainly be willing to meet.
Barbara Slavin directs the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and joins us from Washington. So unexpectedly, because of those tweets last week, Trump said he'd be willing to meet with Rouhani without preconditions. Then after his comments, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said he also supported a meeting, but with preconditions. Do you know what those preconditions would be?
If you've heard Pompeo testify, if you read the speech that he gave, his very first speech as Secretary of State on May the 21st, there was a list of 12 demands for Iran to essentially change almost every aspect of its foreign policy, as well as its nuclear policy. But I think it's rather academic because, as we've seen in the reaction from Tehran over the last 24 hours, they are not exactly jumping up and down to have any kind of meeting with Donald Trump. We have to remember how we got here. Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of a nuclear deal that Iran was complying with. The United States has unilaterally reimposed sanctions that are crashing the Iranian economy. All these companies have started to leave. The currency has lost more than half its value. So why should Iran come back to the table and talk to the United States? I mean, this was all very vague, so we really don't know what it was he meant. And this all could have been just off the cuff, seat of pants, publicity stunt. I mean, we've certainly seen that before from Donald Trump. So we may be taking all of this a little bit too seriously.
If the Iranians considered meeting Trump, what preconditions do you think they would require before such a meeting?
The Iranians have been very clear. They say, you want to talk? Fine. Come back into compliance with the agreement that was reached 3 years ago, not to reimpose sanctions, which are supposed to start coming back into force on August the 6th. And then, you know, they say, sure, we'll be happy to talk. I think they've also seen this movie. They see how Trump summits go. What's in it for them, really? They don't need to have him validating the legitimacy of their government in the same way that Kim Jong-un of North Korea did. They're very suspicious of U.S. motives, and let's face it, there's not a groundswell of support for this on the part of Israel or Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates. I think they would be very, very nervous and upset if such a summit were to take place.
How much do you think Iranian officials are rejecting anything coming from the Trump White House because they're, you know, still raw about Trump pulling out of the nuclear deal?
I think that's a big part of it. I mean, there, you know, this was a two-way street. Could the United States trust Iran? Could Iran trust the United States? And the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, said that the nuclear deal could be the basis for further negotiations with the United States if, you know, all parties met their obligations. Iran has complied. The United States has not. So Iranians would have to be, I think, more desperate than they are now to somehow agree to a meeting under these circumstances.
Do you think the Iranian government is trying to salvage what remains of the nuclear deal with the European partners?
Yes, they're trying to salvage it. With Europe, it's a little bit complicated because of the strength of the American dollar, how important the dollar is in terms of the international financial markets. I think Iran's best bet is with China and Russia, Turkey, India, other countries that have indicated that they will still do business with Iran and that have mechanisms for evading U.S. sanctions. So I think we're seeing a lot of mixed messages out of the administration. There's a lot of confusion, and it'll be interesting to see if President Trump repeats this offer, whether this just sort of fades into the background noise in Washington.
Barbara Slavin, the director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Thanks, as always.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
And now to the Iranian capital. Thomas Erdbrink is the New York Times Tehran bureau chief, which is where he joins us from. What kind of reaction have you been hearing, Thomas, in Tehran to this back and forth with Trump recently?
Well, it's very interesting because we would normally be inclined to ask what Iran's leaders think about this. But the more interesting reaction comes from Iran's people, because when you go on the streets in Tehran, when you take a bus, when you get into an elevator, a lot of people will tell you, of course, we should talk to the United States. This is a perfect opportunity for us. Why are our leaders not taking up this offer from President Trump? This, of course, has to do with Iran's economical situation. The economy has gone downhill ever since the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal. The national currency, the rial, has devalued, some people say, by almost 80%. So people are scared. People want a solution. And that was the word on the street today. And then when you listen to Iran's leaders, you hear something completely different.
And so the reaction from Iranians when they heard that Rouhani was not interested in meeting Trump, what was that?
Well, that is the reaction you will hear more these days in Iran. Something like, oh, our leaders will never change. Or, oh, our leaders are so stubborn. Or, why can't our ideology adjust itself to these different times? There have been protests in Iran in January, very big protests. There have been lots of smaller protests over the past months. This has to do with the economy, but it also has to do with a feeling that many people have that the rules that are set for them inside the Islamic Republic are just too confining. And the relationship with the United States plays a central role in the debate that Iranian people are trying to have with their leaders. And of course, President Trump poured some oil on that fire yesterday by inviting Iran's leaders to talk to them.
So you mentioned the U.S. pulling out of the nuclear deal and reimposing sanctions. We know that's been a big blow to the Iranian economy. But on a day-to-day level, what does that mean for life for people in Tehran, for example?
It basically means that if you would take your bank account and if you would deduct 80% from what you have in savings, then you would have something similar to what Iranians, at least in Tehran, are experiencing.
Wow, that's heavy. Yeah. That's crippling.
That is very crippling. And there's always been inflation here in Iran. This is an oil-based economy. But close to 80%, that is a really big blow to people. And in the wake of that, you can see prices going up. Milk went up by 40% yesterday. Prices of houses and cars have doubled. So you can imagine that if you are an average worker, your purchasing power goes down. You see that your leaders don't want to talk. Yeah, that makes you dissatisfied.
Do you think the Iranian government has just given up dealing with Trump? And if so, where are they looking now for support?
I absolutely don't think they've given up dealing with Trump. I actually think that Iran has a long history of dealing with the United States behind the scenes. Because Iran's ideology is anti-American, Iran's leaders prefer not to make it very clear to their people that they actually speak with the Americans. So what you could see in the lead up to the nuclear agreement, Iranian officials and American officials had direct talks, but in secret. This is, of course, not the modus operandi that President Trump prefers. Mm. He likes to be in front of the cameras, shaking hands. And this also poses a problem for the Iranian leaders because they will be very prone to cut a deal behind the curtains, if you will. But to be in public and have a meeting between Mr. Rouhani and President Trump, ideologically, that would be a long stretch for Iran's leaders.
Thomas Erdbrink, the New York Times Tehran bureau chief, speaking with us from Tehran. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Donald Trump has only been U.S. president a year and a half, but he's already sat down face to face with two of America's leading rivals, Kim Jong-un of North Korea, of course, and Vladimir Putin of Russia. So how unusual is Trump's style of personal diplomacy, and how useful is it? Ryan Crocker served in some of the most difficult diplomatic postings over a lifetime of service, notably as ambassador to Iraq and Afghanistan under George W. Bush. He's now a diplomat in residence at Princeton University. Welcome back to the show, Ambassador. It's not clear if Mr. Trump's offer to meet with the Iranians was spontaneous or part of a well-thought-out strategy, but how would the notion of an important major states meeting typically be brought up in the White House?
Well, first, all diplomacy at the top level ultimately is presidential diplomacy. It's just how our system works. One thinks, for example, of Nixon to China. But the way that worked, of course, Henry Kissinger prepared the way. Nixon knew what the parameters were, what he could expect, what he should try to achieve. What we see with President Trump is very much that shoot-from-the-hip style. These don't seem to fit a logical pattern. You know, what is our strategy here? What are we trying to achieve? They just move on impulse. The latest example, of course, is offer to meet with Iranian President Rouhani anytime, any place. And then, of course, we saw Secretary Pompeo condition all of that. I think the secretary is doing a pretty good job. Part of the effort, obviously, is being sure that we don't get seriously off track with some of the president's impulses. So at the end of the day, it's what the president does that counts. The difference is whether you've had the Sherpas out there preparing that way or whether the president is just winging it. And the latter, I think, can be very dangerous.
So as a U.S. envoy out there in the real world, how would you feel if President Trump or any president wanted to get involved personally, spontaneously in diplomacy in your region?
Well, again, I'm an establishment guy, career in the Foreign Service. I did that stuff. In Iraq, for example, I was ambassador there 2007, 2009, the end of the Bush presidency, and President Bush was very, very directly involved. But in all of his interventions, it's something that we would talk about in advance. Steve Hadley would be involved, the National Security Advisor, Condi Rice, Secretary of State, and me and David Petraeus, Ray Odierno on the military side out in Baghdad. So when the president made an intervention, as he did on a number of occasions, it was something we had all worked up to present him with context, options, risks, gains, the whole deal. The president, at the end of the day, he had a lot of us Sherpas out there working to be sure that what he did had impact, that it made sense at a strategic level, that there were no surprises.
What does it mean if a president does too much personal diplomacy without some kind of commensurate result?
Well, he loses credibility, quite frankly. If he is moving out on a number of these initiatives and they do not show net benefits for U.S. strategic interests, he's cheapened the currency. So that again, is why the preparation is important, why that analysis by senior staff of risks versus gains is, I think, critical for a president to understand what the odds are, what the gains are, what the losses could be before he picks up that phone or gets on that plane.
Well, Trump's offer to Iran is out of the bag. Any specific advice on how Trump should deal with Iran in this case?
Yes, Marco, there is, but it's heavily retrospective. Don't do what you just did. Scrap the Iran nuclear agreement. We are in a fairly major hole right now, and I am not sure how the president intends to get us out of it.
Ambassador Ryan Crocker, now a diplomat in residence at Princeton University. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
You are tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. So here's the scene. President Trump was in southwest Illinois last week, touting the reopening of a steel mill. He credited tariffs for bringing back steel jobs. But Illinois is also soy country. In fact, it's America's number one soy-producing state. And soy and corn farmers are very worried about tariffs, retaliatory tariffs from China. Here's some of what Trump said to them.
And our farmers are patriots. Remember that. Our farmers are patriots. And they're saying the president is doing the right thing. They're saying it. These are incredible patriots. They interview him on television. They say, I know it's going to be a little tough for a while, but he's doing the right thing.
We sent the world's Jason Margolis to Illinois to find out just how patriotic and patient American farmers there are feeling.
About 100 miles from where President Trump was speaking, Phil Seidels raises soybeans and corn. He's 31.
Pull back an ear here, and it's actually maturing rather quickly.
He'll harvest that corn in the fall. Seidels' grandparents started this farm here in Buffalo, Illinois.
Grandma, she's 90 years old and makes this lunch every once in a while, and Grandpa loves coming out, and he's not active in the day-to-day anymore, but still likes to come out and make sure everything's going to plan.
Things aren't going to plan right now. Corn and soybean prices have fallen some 20% since China said it was putting tariffs on them back in the spring.
Yeah, it's hit our bottom line, sure. This is kind of a new playing field for me, especially being a younger generation farmer, is a trade war, and that's a scary term.
Many farmers did lock in contracts before the price slide, and some are simply holding on to their crop until things turn around. Still, some are having to sell while prices are lower. Seidels voted for Trump, and he believes in the president's larger mission, trying to create a more level playing field for U.S. trade overall, not just for agriculture.
I have confidence and hope. You know, he's a businessman and knows what he's doing. I think we can all agree that there have been trade problems in the world.
But Seidels also appears conflicted about the president's tariffs, and he worries about his family's farm.
How long do we have to kind of take it on the nose to see the end game and have those positives of what he's trying to do?
With that in mind, I asked Seidels if he'd vote for Trump again if the election were next week.
To be honest, I really can't answer that.
Can't answer it because you don't know or you don't want to say?
I really don't know. There's a whole heap of things that go into my decision when I make a vote. And yeah, obviously running a business is a huge part of it, but there's a lot of other things, social issues and whole heap of things. So,
I also spoke with a couple of other Illinois soybean farmers, two men in their 50s. Neither wanted to talk about Trump or how they voted in 2016.
I'm just not going to get political.
That's Mark Reichert. He grows soy and corn in Auburn and sits on the Illinois Farm Bureau Board of Directors. He likes that the president has been rolling back some regulations, but Trump's trade policies have him worried that he'll lose customers to places like Brazil.
Now, after all those years of being a trusted trader, now you have to rebuild all those relations. And it's going to take a little ways to recover.
So the Chinese buyer might say, no thanks, we're happy with our Brazilian guys now.
Yeah, you know, it's going to take a lot of work on our part to garner that business back.
To help weather the storm, President Trump announced that he would provide farmers with $12 billion in aid. The three farmers I met all said they appreciate the gesture. But Reichert says,
farmers would much rather embrace the free market. We would much rather have a market for our products than taking welfare.
Soy and corn farmer Dale Haddon in Jacksonville says he's got a better idea what to do with that $12 billion.
Take that $12 billion and use it in improving access to world markets.
In ag towns like Jacksonville, Haddon says it's not just farmers feeling the pain from tariffs.
Had a conversation with a car dealer the other day about my 16-year-old daughter looking for a vehicle. And I asked him, I said, is it having an effect? And he says, definitely it's having an effect. When farmers are not able to produce their crops and get at least what they need to recoup their cost, they're not going to be buyers in the marketplace for new products such as a pickup truck or a new piece of farm equipment or making improvements to a grain handling system. So it's going to have a ripple down effect throughout all of rural America.
So just how long can these farmers and rural America hold out? They've had several difficult years already. I asked Haddon about the president's statements that farmers would be patriots and stand up for his trade policies.
Well, I don't disagree. I know it's important to try and get some level playing fields for some of these other markets. I just hope that we can't stand to be in this predicament price-wise for a very long period of time.
Haddon says if the financial stress continues into next year, people are simply going to give up and sell the farm. Phil Seidels, who's a generation younger, is trying to take the long view.
Grandma and Grandpa literally lived through the Depression and the struggles in the 80s, and then here we are, the third generation, talking about the Tariff of 18.
The Tariff of 18, is that what you guys call it, or you just make that up?
That was just right off the lip there. Just came up with that one right off the lip.
All the farmers I met hope that name sticks, and it doesn't become known as the Tariff of 19 as well, or worse. For The World, Jason Margolis, Buffalo, Illinois.
That story was part of our 50 States project, looking at how the global economy is impacting communities across the U.S. To check out all of our reporting in that series, go to pri.org/50states. So how do you get around the city? We've got a couple of minutes now for a quick postcard from Guyana in South America. My BBC colleague Karinya Sharples has family in the capital, Georgetown, and as you're about to hear, Karinya likes getting around her city on public transportation.
I start in Georgetown's famous Stabroek Market, a hubbub of chatter, sales banter, music from the CD carts, and the sound that typifies this city, car horns. So many journeys start and end at the market. Here, the city's network of private minibuses gather in clusters according to their route number. When I tell some people here that I take the bus, they raise their eyebrows. The minibuses don't have the best of reputations. People complain the music is too loud, they drive too fast, you're squeezed up like sardines in a can. Plus, the seats are positioned in a way that if anyone in your row wants to get out, you have to too, repeatedly. But I like taking the bus. You can hail a ride anywhere and get off where you like, if you shout your stop loudly enough for the driver to hear. I love the place names. Along the way, you hear shouts for Rat Hole and Fried Rice Alley as the bus whizzes down a road known as the railway line. The buses are also a great source of entertainment. They're where I go to hear the latest tunes, where even the most tone-deaf feel free to sing along, and where you'll encounter unexpected acts of kindness. One time, an elderly stranger tapped me on the shoulder and indicated he'd pay for me. On the bus, you see all sorts. Smartly dressed schoolgirls with ribbons at the end of their plaits, sitting almost on top of each other so they can all fit in. Sellers of plantain chips carrying huge laundry baskets of plastic-wrapped snacks. Suited office workers perspiring in the heat. But many people still shy away from hopping on board, preferring to take a taxi.
My BBC colleague, Karinya Sharples, with just a taste of what it's like to ride on the public bus in Georgetown, Guyana. I'm Marco Werman. A filmmaker from Uganda says his life was in danger because he's gay. He flew to the U.S. to seek asylum and wasn't sure what he'd find here.
You don't know if you're just going to be detained at the airport. You don't know if you're just going to be deported. You don't know what's going to happen.
His story, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Getting asylum in any country is a complicated process, and immigration officials take into account lots of things when they're assessing an asylum seeker. In Europe, they're increasingly looking at personal data, data from smartphones, computers, and other electronic devices that migrants bring with them. Immigration advocates worry that in the current climate, with anti-immigration movements sweeping across Europe, that information could be used against asylum seekers. Reporter Morgan Meeker has been following all of this and recently wrote about it for Wired UK Online.
When I was reporting on the refugee crisis in Europe, what I was noticing a lot was wherever I was, whether it was Athens or Berlin or Calais, everybody, asylum seekers who were moving across Europe, were always on their phones. They were enabling them to find out about the routes ahead of them or to contact people smugglers or to stay in touch with families back at home. But as they arrived in countries such as Germany or Denmark or the UK, the data that was carried on their phone was being kind of investigated and used almost against their cases. So if somebody claimed to be in Turkey during a certain date, the immigration agencies could find out whether they were in Turkey using geodata. And if they weren't, they could use that against their asylum application or it would encourage further investigation.
Right. And is it just kind of like geographic placement where people were at a certain point in their travels? Or is there other information officials can pull out of electronic devices that those migrants bring along with them?
Well, it varies country to country. So last year we saw a few different countries, Denmark included, passed legislation that allowed them to interrogate kind of this mobile phone data. And now it's also being considered in Belgium and Austria as well. The UK and Norway have been doing it for a long time. So, for example, in Denmark, the immigration agencies there were able to request that the police extract all a phone's data. So then they're accessing messages, they're accessing information like where a photo has been taken or where a call has been made from, but also information like what language a phone is being used in case somebody is pretending to speak a different language.
Who is doing all the forensics work to extract the data and information we've been talking about? Is it government agencies or are they working with private companies?
So this legislation has been enabled by kind of a boom in what's called a mobile forensics industry. So it's quite like a grey area because it's private companies. We don't know much about it, but it really is taking off. Companies like T3K and MSAB are creating programs. They're the ones who are enabling police to extract all this information and then pass it over to the immigration agencies who can then use it in specific asylum cases.
I mean, when so many migrants enter Europe under the radar, there don't seem to be too many ways to establish factual arrival information other than a person's metadata on their phone. I mean, yeah, there are privacy issues, but really what options do officials have other than looking at the data on someone's cell phone?
Well, I think, yeah, this is obviously an issue for immigration agencies. A lot of people have said they're very unprepared for the big numbers that arrived into Europe. And I think it was in 2016, the German authorities said that 60% of people arrived without any identification documents at all. So they didn't arrive with passports. There was no way to confirm they were who they said they were. And so authorities are increasingly turning to mobile phone data to confirm this. Obviously, it's not infallible. The mistakes can be made. I spoke to somebody who told me a story about one man who said he was in prison during a certain period. And so obviously, because he was in prison, he couldn't access his Facebook. But authorities found that somebody was using his Facebook to comment on photographs. And he said that was his brother. I mean, I don't know whether or not that is correct or not, but it's possible. And so there are kind of like areas of doubt where this information cannot be fully confirmed.
And as far as the privacy issues go, are there activists in the EU who are pushing back against this?
There are activists in Denmark. Welcome Refugees Denmark were very condemning of asylum seekers being asked for their Facebook passwords, for example. Often because people don't know whether it's okay to say no. I spoke to the Danish authorities and they said they do tell asylum seekers that you have to give your consent, but if you don't consent to us, it can have a negative impact on your asylum application. And so obviously, if you're very desperate to enter the country, you're going to say yes. And I spoke to one man who said exactly that, that he was just so desperate to leave the asylum centre that he was living in and to start his normal life that he just said yes straight away. And now looking back on it, he felt that that was unfair to put him in that position.
Reporter Morgan Meeker speaking with us from our studios at the BBC in London. That'll make you think twice about all the data on your phone, at least until the next time you desperately need to Google something, which actually makes for a weird segue to our next story. If you Google asylum seeker, LGBT, and looking for help, a website linked to a church here in Massachusetts pops up. It's in Worcester, about an hour drive west of our studio here in Boston. The church has become a destination for asylum seekers facing persecution in their home countries for their gender or sexual orientation. The World's Lydia Jean Cott went to Worcester to meet some of the people who've sought help there.
I came during the winter season. It was cold, but at least I was safe from the fear.
Safe from the fear, says Thomas, a documentary filmmaker from Uganda. He didn't want to use his real name because he's worried about the safety of his family members, who are still there. Thomas is gay, which as a kid he thought was evil, because in Uganda, gay relationships are illegal.
When I was growing up, I started cursing myself, being attracted to men, and asking myself, is this evil really in me? There was no one I could talk to share it with, so I kept it to myself.
But Thomas didn't exactly stay silent. He started making documentaries about how gay people are treated in Uganda. While filming one of them, he was arrested and outed to his community. Violence against gay people is common in Uganda, and Thomas feared for his life. He had a visa to come to the U.S. since he had been in the country for a screening of one of his films, and a friend told him about this church in Massachusetts that could help him. So he got a plane ticket.
You don't know if you're just going to be detained at the airport. You don't know if you're just going to be deported. You don't know what's going to happen. It's like being on a canoe in the middle of the ocean.
What happened is, a volunteer picked up Thomas from the airport and brought him to Hadwin Park Church, a little white clapboard church with a steeple, where he could finally feel safe. Over the past decade, through a mostly volunteer program called the LGBT Task Force, the church has helped about 150 asylum seekers like Thomas. It gives them housing and a stipend while they wait for their work permits. Most of the money for the program comes from donations from other churches, but that doesn't cover everything. That's why these asylum seekers decided to form a choir to perform at a fundraising gala. The gala isn't until October, which is good, because Deacon Al Green and Reverend Judith Hanlon, or as everyone calls her here, Pastor Judy, don't think they're quite ready.
All right.
Good?
80%.
Just be together. That sounds beautiful.
Two men in the choir are a couple. They didn't want to use their names while their asylum cases are pending. They came here from Jamaica, where they had to date in secret for years because of the anti-gay violence there. That's why the first question that Pastor Judy asked them took them aback.
She didn't ask if we're going to get married. Our first question to us was,
are you going to book the church anytime soon?
Are you booking the church?
That was her question, her question to us.
I'd always thought that this was not the thing to be doing. You know, how could I possibly go into church and ask God's blessing on a marriage between, you know, two guys?
They did get married in May at the church here. And Pastor Judy officiated.
We didn't even plan a reception after the wedding, but
the task force,
all of our LGBTQ friends, they
reception.
Just decided.
I was like,
we got down and it was a surprise. We had all the rainbow colors, mm-hmm. like it's all decked
it was
out.
So pretty.
No matter how much support Pastor Judy and Hadwin Park Church provide, they can't guarantee that all the asylum seekers they help will be able to stay in the United States. Thomas, the filmmaker, filed for asylum in June. He still doesn't have a court date. Until he gets one, he's living with uncertainty. So he's dealing with it the best way he knows how, through shooting another documentary. The working title is Away From Home.
I've started working on a film for the asylum seekers here in the U.S. The life we go through, I think it will be a powerful story.
For The World, Lydia Jean Cott, Worcester, Massachusetts.
By now, you've probably heard the name Maria Butina. She was a graduate student at American University in Washington. But Butina was no ordinary student. According to U.S. prosecutors, she was an undercover agent for the Kremlin who was trying to cultivate connections with American politicians. And here's the thing. Butina didn't really hide her Russian ties.
I would like to know more about your laws, about laws of different countries, and especially about practice and experience.
That's Butina speaking in a video posted on YouTube. If she had said those words during the Soviet era, she'd have been flagged immediately as a spy. But today, for some reason, her comments don't raise many suspicions. Why is that? Well, let's ask Daniel Golden, who has researched how foreign governments plant spies in American universities. He wrote a book about it called Spy Schools, How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploit America's Universities. Dan Golden, welcome.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So explain why Butina's words and actions did not raise suspicions at American University in Washington when she was there.
I guess they didn't raise suspicions because she appears to have been very out front about what she thought and her support of the Putin regime and her interest in American politics. And people have a stereotype of a spy as somebody who stays in the shadows and is undercover and doesn't express their real opinions. There is some truth to that stereotype. So what that suggests to me is that Putin may not have been the traditional trained to be a spy by Russian intelligence to steal secrets, but rather what's known as an agent of influence, somebody who comes over and tries to ingratiate themselves in order to influence politics.
On the campus of American University, though, there's some pretty colorful details about her time there, including, I mean, she walked around with a cell phone case with Vladimir Putin's picture posted on it.
That's right. As we said, she was very upfront and didn't waste any time and I guess took quite a few people aback with the strength of her opinions.
How unusual do you think the case of Maria Butina is? I mean, as this agent of influence on a U.S. campus.
I don't think it's that unusual. I mean, as I've traced in my book and articles, there's a long history of Russia and other countries targeting American universities. And as the number of foreign students has increased, now we're up to about 1 million or so, more than half what we had, say, 20 years ago. There's more and more efforts to gain information and recruits at universities. And it's turned academia into kind of a front line for espionage because the U.S. engages in the same thing. We identify foreign students that might be helpful to us and try and recruit them and send them home as our agents. So there's a kind of spy versus spy war that my book is about.
Do you have an example, a good example of another case of either an agent of influence or an actual spy from Russia or any other country that's been on a U.S. University campus?
Sure. In 2010, there's the famous case of 10 Russian, quote-unquote, illegals who were rounded up. Illegals because they didn't have diplomatic cover. They were kind of sleeper agents planted in the country. And of those 10, 7 of them went to American universities as students, and one also taught. And their instructions were explicitly to get to know professors that they might recruit, find out secrets, identify classmates who might be helpful, and try and steer them into federal positions. That case is quite famous, and there's been many others going back as far as the 1920s and 1930s in the Soviet era.
With all the foreign university students in the States right now, what are your concerns about getting suspicious of anyone or everyone around us who, you know, we might not know, especially in this post-9/11 atmosphere where some people have been flagged unjustly?
Yeah, I think there's a concern. And this is not something that should be overstated. I mean, the vast majority of foreign students are not collecting intelligence for their countries. And the other thing that we should worry about and caution against is some kind of blanket move to stop foreign students from coming to the country. The espionage is one element in a larger picture. Now, there are things universities can do to lessen the threat, and we could talk about those if you want.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a moment. Let me ask you this first, though. While people may be clutching their pearls in shock at Maria Butina, I guess you could argue that if the U.S. sent spies to other countries' universities, why wouldn't other countries do the same to us?
Yeah, it's a two-way street. It's a game that both sides play. Now, the Butina one is particularly concerning because it seems to fit in a larger pattern of Russia's efforts to influence American elections.
So back to that question, what is the lesson for universities with all this? How do they maintain a rigorous watch over that without infringing on student rights?
Well, they don't maintain a rigorous watch. Universities tend to look the other way. Now, that may be because foreign students pay full tuition, and many of them have campuses abroad that are subsidized by the host government. What they could do, for example, in the Butina case, it's possible that American University could revoke her degree if she's convicted of being an unregistered foreign agent. In most cases, with a few exceptions, when students or alumni have been exposed as spies, the universities haven't done anything.
Daniel Golden is the author of Spy Schools, How the CIA, FBI, and Foreign Intelligence Secretly Exploit America's Universities. Dan, thanks very much for coming in.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
A couple of weeks ago, we sent a team of reporters to London. They were there to cover Trump's meeting with Theresa May and the whole Brexit thing. And that they did, but they came home talking about something else, Love Island.
Love Island, 6 weeks in paradise.
Hello?
Is Jonathan there?
This is a reality TV show that has taken the UK by storm. It's the British equivalent of Bachelor in Paradise, so it's not the most highbrow entertainment.
What do you think about Brexit?
What's that? Like,
we're leaving the European Union.
I seriously don't have.
So like, if you, so it's to, it was to leave the EU, so we wouldn't be part of
EU,
Europe,
yeah,
which would,
yeah,
mean like welfare and like things we trade with would be cut down.
So does that mean we won't have any trees?
Trees? Oh
no,
that's got nothing to do with it, babe. That's weather.
Wouldn't we have trees?
What are you talking about?
No, we're just not in the European Union. We're still classed as, like, being in Europe.
Doesn't it mean it would be harder to, like, go to, like, Spain and stuff?
So it'd be harder to go on holidays?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, I love my holidays.
Yeah.
It's a good thing eye-rolling doesn't make noise. Anyway, the show has won a BAFTA. That's the British equivalent of an Emmy. It's ITV2's most watched show ever. And it's sparking a national conversation in the UK about, yeah, silly stuff for sure, but also about the treatment of women and diversity. Writer and Love Island superfan Daisy Buchanan joins me. Hi, Daisy.
Hi there.
So for those of us on this side of the pond who have been deprived of Love Island, I want to just kind of help us understand what's up. Let me play this clip from the series premiere.
We have found the hottest and naughtiest boys and girls around, and we put them all in here. This incredible luxury villa. And in 6 weeks' time, your favourite couple will walk away with £50,000. Yes, true. There's eye candy for the girls and an eye-popping feast of beef coke for us girls. Yay! Since our hotties arrived only 48 hours ago, there's already been bed-hopping, breakups and a little bit of loving. Hashtag classic Love Island. And it's only going to get a lot hotter because live tonight, we're going to be dropping in a couple of love grenades.
Oh, a little something for everybody. Daisy, describe a little bit more what a Love Island is all about and throw in too, what is a love grenade?
Well, I think you had it right when you said about The Bachelor in Paradise. For my money, Love Island is The Bachelor meets Mad Max. It's a dating show for sure, but it's maybe, you know, where you have a little bit of ceremony and gentility. On Love Island, it gets kind of crazy. So, you know, a love grenade, you know, that could be anything. Quite often it's like an extra person thrown into the island who causes havoc and chaos. So throughout, people have to choose partners to stay with and decide whether to stick or twist. And there were definitely guys where if you put a balloon over the wall and drew a face on the balloon and put a wig on it, they'd say, oh, well, I want to keep my options open. I was just talking about marriage and babies with Laura or Megan, but that balloon looks hot. And lots of critics here have said that, you know, one of the big problems on the show is it's not very diverse. You know, you don't see a lot of people of colour. It's incredibly white. It's also, you know, everyone's sort of very slim, very muscular. But I have found it quite comforting to know that you can look like that and still have a very imperfect love life. It's quite comforting.
I mean, you're obsessed with this show. A lot of people are. Why?
I mean, I think part of it is that it's on every single night. You know, we had Saturdays off, and, you know, even on Saturdays, you get a sort of Love Island supplement, a roundup of what was going on the week. And I
really?
Think part of it is that in this time of streaming, when we don't necessarily watch TV together anymore, you know, there's this cult of kind of internet obsession and a fear of spoilers, and we consume things in a very intense way. And Love Island could be consumed quite intensely, but to really enjoy it and engage with it, you had to watch almost in real time. And I think that for me, certainly, what I loved about watching it was watching on Twitter and having these chats with all of these fans from everywhere. And it was one of the few instances of communal coming together and watching at a time when that's quite rare. It was interesting that so much of it happened during the World Cup as well, because you had it on both sides. And I think that one thing really whetted appetites for the other.
There's been this outcry, as you know, about the treatment of women on the show. The charity Women's Aid even put out a statement after one episode about how to spot signs of emotional abuse. What happened there?
So one of the contestants, Adam, gaslighted another contestant, Rosie. She, I think, in a way that was very brave and very clear-eyed, calmly sat down and said,
you can't treat girls like that. You will never, ever be happy because you're constantly searching for more. You trick girls into thinking that you're in here for a serious relationship. You're not. You're in here to rack up your numbers, Adam.
Yeah.
Because you know what? You made me believe that we really had something.
And Adam responded, and I paraphrase this, but broadly, you are crazy. You are the one with the problem. There is nothing wrong with my behaviour. That is fine. And I think, you know, Adam really abused his power. There's a fairly common consensus on that. You know, I think that most people will recall a moment where someone did that to them in their romantic past. And by putting it on Love Island and seeing that, you know, almost, well, not in black and white, in full HD in colour, but could you all take that and realise that just because this does happen all the time doesn't mean it's not a problem. It is a problem.
Now that the season of Love Island is over, Daisy, what are you planning on doing with your nights now?
Oh, just crying. You know, looking out into space and crying. I might finally read Proust.
That is a very good plan. Daisy Buchanan in London, good to have you.
Thank you so much.
This is new music out today from an island. This is reggae from Guam. The group is simply called Four Peace Band. It's pretty clear what they stand for. And this opening track on their newly minted CD is appropriately titled Always Love. You see what's going on here?
Don't let no one tell you what you've got to be. Just be yourself, the one is right for what to see. Like a tree that is planted and free. Give thanks for life, appreciate love, the little things. Keep your cool. Don't be a fool when them a judge you and call you a liar. No, 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 no. Love
what you do.
Always love.
Keep your cool, don't be a fool. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Public Radio International.